Welcome to the Catbird Speaks, the podcast for BP Southside, the baseball prospectus local site covering the Chicago White Sox. You can find this podcast on iTunes or our Blog Talk Radio page by searching for the Catbird Speaks. Joining you today from Austin, Texas, this is Colin Whitchurch, and joined as always in Manhattan, it is Nicky Beeps, Nick Schaefer. What's up, Nick?
Hey, everybody. Happy Sunday.
Also joining us is BP Southside writer, senior writer, I don't remember titles, from Las Vegas, our resident animal expert, Dr. 100, Mark Primiano.
I didn't know I had a title.
You've got a title.
I just thought I was a writer.
Yeah, you know, it doesn't really matter, I guess.
I feel fancy now.
Also joining us, a very special guest, whose voice you may be familiar with from practically every other episode of this podcast in history. It is the Athletic White Sox writer and BP Southside editor emeritus, James Fegan. What's up, James?
You guys are really going all in with the nicknames on the broadcast, huh?
Yeah, you know, you're not the host anymore. I make the rules. Deal with it.
Yeah, James, if you want to, you know, for our listeners, explain who you are, what's your relationship with the White Sox, give us a little background on you.
I'm a beloved figure in White Sox franchise history.
So they'll make you manager to disastrous consequences?
down the road. Just when goodwill towards me has peaked.
Oh!
I think we're well past that.
Are you reacting to Jose Abreu?
Yep. Sorry, that's terrible radio.
Like, it could be that or, like, a dog stepped on your foot. Like, it really wasn't that clear.
He doesn't have a dog.
Nope.
Sad. Well, you know your former
staff. That would only
members.
Increase the surprise, wouldn't it?
See?
Yeah,
that's why.
If
that's,
I stepped on my foot, I'd be mad.
That's why Mark is our animal expert. He knows who has dogs and who doesn't.
Yeah. I'm actually playing catch with mine right now.
I'm the White Sox beat writer of sorts for The Athletic, but I don't travel that often. I'm mostly interdivisional games, so I did not go to Canada, so I'm watching the game at home with all of you. And probably need to start
writing. We are all together watching a game.
Did you make it out to Seattle, or am I imagining things?
I did go to Seattle.
That was a good series to go to.
It was. I mean, it was three road series in a row, and so I went to the one in the middle because I didn't want to be away from the team that long, and I just kind of decided I'm doing it. My bosses said, okay, but at that point, I had already bought my ticket. So, but it worked out well. And then, you know, of course, Rickon and Carlos Rodon talked to media in Arizona after I'd gone home. So that was great.
Yeah. Do you have any more information beyond the press release on Miguel Gonzalez's injury, which was, I think that was, well, that press release went out this morning, right?
That'd be correct.
Sprained AC joint, 10-day DL, if I'm not mistaken.
I can tell you that it kind of came out of nowhere, and he had never talked about being in pain or dealing with soreness before, and he wasn't, like, wearing any kind of wrap or anything after his last start or the day after that, so it was kind of a surprise. Like most of the pitchers on the White Sox staff, he gets that weird, like, cupping thing that, like, swimmers do around his arm and, like, throwing joint, which gives him all, like, this weird...
It's like those. I've seen it. It's like those welts, sort of. Yeah. These little circular welts on your, well, wherever you put it.
Yeah, ton of guys have that
in the last Olympics. Yeah.
So he gets that done, like during like a certain point of his between starts. But you know, Quintana does that. Holland does that. It seems like normal maintenance. So I don't really think it's like was treating any kind of like symptoms necessarily. It's just a weird thing that I witnessed once and almost made me throw up.
Yeah, it's quackery.
Actually, we have. I know
pure
so we
and
have
unadulterated
a
quackery.
We have a medical professional of sorts on the cast. I've noticed that, and maybe
he's an injury expert.
He's got more qualifications than some injury experts.
Man, my head looks like less of an egg.
The AC joint. I feel like they've been sort of announcing DL stints this year across the majors with more specificity because I feel like it used to just be like. Shoulder, they just call it shoulder, but now I'm noticing like Bumgarner, they call it AC joint. And here,
when you say an AC joint sprain, it's basically, it is a separated shoulder. AC joint sprain is just like a more specific way of saying separated shoulder. And it comes in a couple grades. The shoulder is a very weird and inconvenient joint to injure. I think I've written about this when Danks destroyed his, because it's not like a traditional joint where you think of like the hip where you've got your ball and socket, or the wrist where there's a billion little things holding it together. Your shoulder is very, very strange, because you've got your humeral head attaching to your clavicle and attaching to your scapula, and these are all bones that really don't like link up very nicely. It's very ugly, and there's very small parts that when it gets hurt, it generally doesn't heal great.
And to be clear, Gonzalez, I misspoke. He doesn't have a sprain. It's being listed as inflammation. So am I correct that the AC joint fell further? I don't think they have the grade, but is the AC joint like further forward on the shoulder, or am I mistaken? It's like near the top of the chest.
Like the highest point of the shoulder.
Oh, okay. Well, there you go, guys.
Is there any thought that maybe this is not correct to assume such things, but is there any thought that this is just one of those, hey, he's been kind of terrible, so let's... It wouldn't necessarily be a DL stint if he wasn't so shitty right now, but we're going to make him go on the DL so that we can eventually rehab him, et cetera, kind of things?
Yeah, I mean, yes and no, in the sense that, I mean, I haven't read his entire comments today, but it sounds like he was trying to pitch through it. And, like, he said something about, like, I think he told Daryl Benchowen that he'd been feeling it for a month. Wow. I think if he had been successfully pitching through it, that would probably change the calculus on it a bit. Not necessarily that's gotten worse, but just, like, I'm feeling soreness and I'm not getting results. Maybe we should just rest rather than continue to go out there and have bad results on a weekly basis.
And speaking of bad results, James Shields comes out to take his place in the rotation. I don't know if – I remember when he made his initial rehab start in Charlotte, but I haven't been paying too close attention to how he's been doing down there. I don't know if anybody else has been – I don't know what the expectation is for Shields at this point.
For the most part.
Yeah. But I guess Shields probably poses as good of a bet as pretty much anybody in the rotation now, going more than four innings in a given outing.
Yeah, he's a guy who at the very least, if he's struggling, you know, is not going to like completely wear down. And, you know, if it's a day after the bullpen had to cover seven innings because Holmberg or whoever starts, that he can just wear one if necessary. But, you know, we're watching Sunday's game. He's in at 61 pitches in the fifth inning without a run allowed. And I know he was kind of gutting out some performances early in the season before he went down with an injury, but I think at the very least he's going to help save the bullpen from overworking themselves to death.
Go ahead, James.
His adaptation to being old would probably be more interesting if, one, he had, you know, made more than three starts, and two, if this was a team that, like, he was like the, you know, cagey fifth starter on an actual contender rather than just some guy eating innings during a rebuild. He's throwing his fastball a lot less, which is good because, like, I think it's like 89 to 91 right now. He's throwing a ton of slow curveballs, which is in line with the entire pitching staff, throwing more curveballs. So he's kind of doing the old man adjustments that you kind of hoped he would do last year when he was getting shelled as the team was going down in flames. But it does seem like that's finally coming.
Do you guys know the Yukon territory is considered blackout territory for the Blue Jays? You can be touching Alaska in Canada, and you will not be able to watch Blue Jays games on MLB.tv.
That's great.
That's ridiculous.
Was there any – I know that Kansas City made a big deal about having Shields, like, as a mentor for their pitching staff when he first came over in that Will Myers trade. Was there any mention or sense that Shields getting some time in AAA would be to the benefit of the myriad pitching prospects who are very relevant to the near future of the team?
I know Lucas Giolito specifically said that Shields pointed out something he was doing with his legs and his delivery I know Shields talked about that he spoke with Fulmer and guys like that a couple times. He was very active talking with Dylan Covey when he was up. So it's definitely a role he does engage very naturally and actively. So I think he'd only be positive. I don't think it'd be positive enough that Shields would be willing to just stick at AAA long term to be Lucas Giolito's pitching coach. But yeah, he's definitely good for that aspect. He knows he's old. He makes a lot of jokes about it, and he helps out when he can.
Do you have you heard anything? The trade deadline for the White Sox thing, even coming into the season, it was always very strange after the two big trades over the winter, because you have these guys like Quintana and Abreu who, you know, if you don't get the right offer, there's plenty of time to hang on to them, and there's plenty of reason to have them around. You've got the rental guys, you've got the bullpen pieces. Is there any sense that now that the draft is over, there's some sort of growing imminence on anything there?
On something particular, no. Did Rick Hahn specifically say, now that the draft is over, expect lots of trades? Pretty much, yeah. When we were, you know, beating down his door about trades over and over again, earlier in the year, he was like, you know, we're focusing on the draft right now. Probably other teams are doing that. That's where everyone's scouts are pretty much dedicated. Though that was kind of a weird comment, since amateur and pro scouts are kind of usually separate. But now the draft is over, he does expect things to accelerate. Yeah, it's what, just a little over a month and a half away, or less than a month and a half. Things should probably pick up for Robertson. They have to make a decision on the Swarzak since he's a free agent. I'm betting Miguel Gonzalez is not moving the deadline at this point, given that he's been struggling and hurt. I would doubt that Shields goes, but I guess it's possible since he's only contracted through next year. The 2019 season's an option. He'd have to really shove, and he's probably going to do more just weird old man tricks than look like a playoff starter. So I adore his old man tricks. They're very charming. Throwing 69-mile curveballs is awesome.
Nice.
I don't know.
You don't like Donaldson hitting it 405 feet or whatever the center field fence is minus 5 feet. It's like a sustainable strategy.
It kind of is.
They measure in meters up there.
It's true. Yeah, I guess even after April, it looked like Holland Gonzalez might wind kind of interesting. But we were talking a little bit about this on Twitter and in the Slack. There's the way, especially the National League has shaken out. I feel like the trade market is going to be even more chaotic than one might have anticipated, because there were a lot of teams that I had sort of circled as potential trade partners coming into the year. Like, I don't know, I guess St. Louis maybe is still in it enough, but I thought the Mets would be a team that would be really interested in the White Sox services.
Or the Giants.
The Giants. And both those teams have imploded so hard just immediately. I have a hard time seeing either of them buying a Rangers article.
I mean, I could see the Mets tricking themselves into buying still, because it's the Mets, and anything they do, you can just be like, yeah, what's the worst course of action we could take? Let's do it.
Yeah.
The Giants, though, Jesus, 26-44. Like, no, they have to just pack it in.
But the other side of that, too, is that other trade partners that still look like they could fit would be Houston and the Nationals, and they clinched their division in, like, early May.
Yeah.
So they can be very patient, picky, even though the Nationals' bullpen is the subject of, like, humor writing at this point.
Yeah.
They have Jacob Turner and Matt Albers are getting, like, tons of innings for them.
The Cubs, when they traded for Aroldis Chapman last year, that wasn't like a, we're in danger of not winning the division, we need Aroldis Chapman. That was obviously a very playoff-focused move. So I think things like that. So I think guys like David Robertson and Swarzak, for the sake of like loading up a playoff caliber bullpen, would still be on the table. But I think like the standard I've been like going off of for what would be good enough to be a starter trade at the deadline was Wade Miley's traded. The Orioles traded for Wade Miley last year just because they needed somebody who was a competent starter to be in the rotation.
The White Sox traded for James Shields.
Oh. Obviously, the Astros don't need to like trade for a number four starter to win the NL West.
But they getting another good starter wouldn't. Honestly, a number four starter would help them a lot right now. They've got three guys on the 10-day DL.
Right.
They're out to that ridiculous league. But yeah, they could really, really use another starter pretty much just from attrition.
Yeah.
And if you want to get into the playoffs and have your rotation be, if everyone's healthy, McCullers, Keuchel, Fears, like, this is a gross rotation.
Yeah, so that's why I would still think they would probably be interested in someone from Quintana tier or someone they can be helped, like, you know, be confident putting out in game two or game three of the playoffs rather than maybe someone more like Derek Holland. But as you said, they got enough attrition in their rotation where if Holland was available for a song, that might be interesting for them too.
They've got the offense that's going to carry them far enough, but that pitching is just, you look at it and you go, that can't win a World Series.
I mean, Charlie Morton actually is throwing, you know, he was throwing harder and he was looking like he might be sort of number three starter quality behind, you know, Keuchel and McCullers. But this was the problem I was calling out with the Astros rotation coming into the season is like these guys have long injury histories and don't throw a ton. I mean, if you're saying McCullers and Morton are going to be our two and three for a 162-game season, like you're going to need, well, under normal circumstances, you'd need more arms just to get you through. Obviously, if, you know, you have, you know, a team OPS of like 880 or whatever the hell it is over there, then, and the rest of your division is what it is, you know, they can, like James said, I mean, if you want to do the Ariel Miranda Wade Miley trade again, like, sure, for Holland or something like that. But I would think the Astros would be more interested in grabbing a third frontline starter to be there, especially if McCullers doesn't go into the postseason healthy. I'd say Archer was the other name that was being thrown around with Quintana before the season, and he's obviously gotten off to a much better start than Quintana has. But the Rays aren't sellers right now, I don't think.
They should be. I hate them.
I think they're ultimately going to be, and they have, I mean, we talk about Archer versus Quintana on the trade market. They also have, like, Alex Colomay, who is a decent bullpen piece that is off to a pretty good start this year, I think, in the market of where David Robertson will go.
Robertson's missing more bats.
Yeah.
He's
more handsome.
He's also older, and more expensive, I would assume, both of those things without knowing for a fact.
Seems like
Colomé is making $500,000. No, wait, Fangraphs is wrong, because it hasn't updated it in a year. Great.
He's 28 years old, and he's
Colomé is making
$548,000. So $48,000 more than Fangraphs thinks. And he's not a free agent until 2021.
That might make him a bit more expensive talent-wise.
Yes.
Do you, James, the history of the White Sox in the rare situations where they've actually been sellers has been to insist that whoever they trade with take on the full salary of whatever they're dealing. You know, given that this offseason has been in many respects seen as like a sort of a sea change in how they do business, has there been any statement or sense or discussion over, you know, are they going to keep doing that, insist whoever they trade with takes on 100% of the salary at the expense of talent coming back the other way?
I mean, I would assume not, because your roster is pretty inexpensive. They might, you know, be of the standpoint of we just paid near 50 million, close to 50 million, given taxes for Luis Robert, that they have some sort of a compulsion from above to save money. I'm trying to remember if Han said something specific about it. I think not, because I probably would have tweeted it out like it was Pearl Harbor news if he said that they were going to take on money in trades. But you would think that they would realize this is their time to kind of, you know, take a bath somewhat financially for the sake of loading talent. But there is, you know, given that they kind of went over the board about Robert, there's a chance that they're still going to stick in their stubborn ways. I wouldn't anticipate them making someone eat all of David Robertson, but they probably want most of it taken on by the other team.
I guess it's hard to speak in the abstract because it's like, I don't know what if we actually had it in front of us where we could say, well, here's deal A where you get, you know, this prospect for this much money, and here's deal B where you get lesser prospect for this much money and whatever.
Yeah, they should really put out like PowerPoints when they announce these trades to make it clear.
Right, because then if you're a team who was shopping a player and they didn't know, it's always good that they find out, even if you weren't going to trade them. It's probably good for morale.
For sure.
I think, I mean, do you think, does anybody think Frazier or Melky is getting anything at this point
on the market? I mean Adam, like Dunn, Adam Dunn got Nolan Sandberg, and that wasn't just like absolutely nothing. I mean, he wasn't.
Nolan Sandberg is no longer with the organization.
Well, so I know, but he wasn't
at the time, just, though.
Great, but it was at the time. It was just like, okay, that's actually surprisingly more than I thought we would get.
Yeah,
I think either or both it should get you at least like a low A lotto ticket, maybe a future reliever kind of guy, which ain't nothing, you know. Especially with the White Sox history of developing pitchers, it's like I don't quite understand the new free agent rules. Like, if they let them walk, they basically don't get shit for them, right? And draft, from a draft perspective,
I need to educate myself on the new CBA. I think it's more. I'm pretty sure you're looking at lower. I think you're getting lower picks, and it's harder to get them than it used to be.
Frazier is basically an 830 OPS over the last 30 games. So he's hidden.
And his defense is held up.
I guess my thought is there any logical reason for, like, well, let's not trade them because at least we still get X? Is that even an argument that can be made?
If by X you mean, like, clubhouse leadership, yes. And or enjoyment from watching Melky Cabrera be Melky Cabrera.
Fair.
I get the sense that Frazier is a more valuable piece on the market, and Melky is fun to have around regardless. I mean, Swarzak seems to me like that'd be an easy guy to deal. I would think that somebody would want someone who's pitching that well, and given that he'd be a cheap rental, that there'd be some sort of fit somewhere. Canely is interesting to me because I feel like if the team decides they wanted to trade him, which, you know, you wouldn't necessarily want to do, but if you did, that would look more like that'd be more of an off-season type deal, I would think, because he's sort of a long-term piece rather than a trade deadline rental type guy.
Yeah, he has all of his arb years left. I mean, I still think he would push him at the deadline. You just probably have to pay a pretty penny. Swarzak's been kind of low-key not that great since April.
Sure.
I think he's got a 4.19 ERA since then and kind of underwhelming strikeout rates. He's been fine. He just hasn't been Tommy Canley 2.0 since then.
Right. I have to go back. It's very subjective. I have to look and see. I don't know if he's fatiguing due to heavy usage. I feel like Swarzak's picked up a lot of the slack from the 4-plus inning and dive rotation they've been implementing for the last month or so.
Yeah, I mean, Ricky, I mean, not to the extent of, I mean, maybe it's not to the extent of Ventura, but maybe it's more just the way the season is focused doesn't seem to be as strict about this is my bullpen when I'm losing, this is my bullpen when I'm winning. But the way the season has been, he's been able to protect Canley and Swarzak. I'm betting that you're probably not going to find either of those guys really that high up as you think on number of appearances league-wide.
Probably
just
not.
Just because you know, when the things are going bad, he's pretty good at using his other layer of guys.
Let's see if I can pull up. I mean, this would be, I guess Swarzak threw a ton of innings in the minors last year. I was gonna see what sort of usage rate he's had over the last few years, but he's got a long track record. I mean, he was a starter for a while, spot starter for a while, so this shouldn't be too much work for him either. So,
yeah, there's no one on the White Sox in the top 30 of reliever appearances.
I haven't looked. I know that something that used to drive me crazy was Ventura used to warm guys like multiple times and not use them in games. I don't know if there's been improvement there from Renteria as well.
I would say so for the most part. The only counterexample I can really think is when he had Robertson do that two-inning save in Cleveland. He had Canley warming the entire time in case it went bad. And he wound up holding Canley out, and then after using everyone else, he used Canley like multiple innings the next day, which I thought was pretty smart.
I feel like Dan Jennings has pitched every single day. I can't believe that he's not in the near the leaderboard in appearances.
Yeah, well, he's not. So,
all right. Well,
what about you, man?
That's what I was trying to say when my mic was muted for the last few minutes.
I like that you self-muted. That was very disciplined of you.
Yeah. Well, you know, I gotta make a noise, and you mute.
He leads the team.
Yes.
He hasn't been that good.
No, he has not.
No, this has been a marked. I mean, so much of that for him, though. His peripherals have been. His strikeout to walk ratio has been pretty terrible ever since he joined the White Sox. His saving grace was that he suppressed homers like crazy, and then he gave up, what, two in that one game or something like that? Or he gave up a few in rapid succession. And that balloons his FIP over 5. He's still a useful guy to have around because he's can be used in a lot of low leverage situations, but it's definitely been a step back for him. He's still doing better than Andre Rienzo though, right? Am I crazy?
Yeah, I think Andre Rienzo is not on the 40 man in the San Diego organization. So,
oh, he's in
yeah.
San Diego now. I was hoping he was still in New Orleans baby cake.
He's got a 2.43 ERA in AAA.
He is a New Orleans baby cake.
There you go.
Why is San Diego's AAA team in New Orleans? That sounds like hell.
Wikipedia said he currently pitches for the New Orleans baby cakes, but it lied. He's an El Paso Chihuahua right now.
I love the minor leagues so much.
Same. I think Vegas is an affiliate that like nobody wants, and I'm pretty sure the Mets. Yeah,
it's because Mark's
like, lost.
They were originally a Padres affiliate back in the day, and it made all the sense in the world. So you're like, okay, that's right down the road. And then I know there were a Blue Jays one not too long ago. I think right before they were the Mets, they were the Blue Jays, and back in the day they were the Dodgers, which also made sense because I remember Edwin Jackson. In MVP 05 was a Las Vegas 51.
That's a weird thing to remember.
Yeah, I remember more about that video game than I do most people I grew up with. I specifically failed a pre-calc test because it came out like right before that exam. And while I was taking the test, the soundtrack from it just kept going in my head. And I was like, okay, we have a problem.
The minor league affiliate right down the road from me is changing from the Rangers to the Astros next year, I believe. So, fun fact.
I'm trying to remember. We'd have to ask our prospects team. I think there was something where, like, people don't – I think affiliates don't like working with the Mets or something like that. And so the Mets got stuck with Vegas, I'm pretty sure. Because I think the Mets had – Buffalo or something, or maybe that was Cleveland. Either way, that change happened somewhat recently because I think Toronto had Vegas up until like 2-3 years ago.
Yeah, you're right. That
Which
was a weird
made
home run.
Made as much sense as the Mets having Vegas. But did you guys have any like strong opinions about the draft, or is it just sort of made sense? Move on, or
Let's ask James what he thinks.
It was kind of weird.
Yeah.
All right, moving on.
I mean, you hear about best player available all the time. But given the fact that the draft was like so mediocre in talent level, and also like the kind of how the stratification of talent was kind of up for dispute, it kind of seems like they looked for a type. They just looked for polished college power all over the top of the draft, which is unusual, I guess, to see a team kind of like say, we need this type of player and just draft it over and over again.
I thought it was crazy that they, I couldn't really figure out if it was more coincidence based on who was on the board when they were picking or if there was more of a strategy involved that they, I think they picked a high schooler at 9, which was that kid who didn't even know he was going to get drafted at all, it seemed. And then they didn't take another high schooler until like the 38th round or something like that. It was all college players.
Yeah. So. They took a guy, Sammy Abbott, I think it was the 8th round. Who is a water polo, like, U.S. junior national player or something like that.
Yeah, from Spokane.
A high school first baseman with enormous raw power who hit 2 home runs in his senior year of high school. So it's literally not even, like, showing up in games in high school yet, this raw power that he has.
It was a workout wonder, right? Like, they flew him in and he worked out at stadium or something, and they're like, oh, shit, we're drafting this guy.
He had some insane batting practice session that Jim Tomei loved.
And it sounds like according to Future Sox, he is signing too.
Yeah. He's around after a almost indefinitely overslot pick of Evan Skoug. So draw what conclusions you will between those guys being one round to the next.
Is that how you pronounce Skoug? Are you sure of that?
I have no idea. I'd have to go back and listen to the tape. I probably screwed it. I hope
it's Skoug.
The newspaper, one of the newspapers I designed did a centerpiece feature on him just the other day because he's from that area. And I believe in the phone conversation I had with them, they pronounced it Skoug. And I feel like they would know.
I feel like James would know, but I guess not.
Yeah.
I mean, I know Nick Hostetler said it, and he said the way that he was supposed to say it, but I don't remember. I thought it was Skoug.
I'm going to go Skoug.
It could be Skoug. It could be Skoug.
I'm going to pronounce it Skag.
It could be Skooge. It could be a soft G.
It definitely could not matter because he might just be terrible because he's an 8th-round draft pick.
He was definitely an overspot pick, though. I mean, I think there was a more hype around him like a couple of years ago.
Skoug was 7th round, Abbott was 8th.
Whatever.
Abbott, what's funny, though, is it's like, you know, normally with multi-sport athletes, or especially coming out of high school, it's like, I don't know if we could get him away from his like basketball commit to Kentucky or whatever. And it's like, yeah, I think we can outbid the water polo league or whatever it might be.
He was Long Beach really State, right? Is that where he was committed to play water polo? I think.
Yeah. I don't know, Colin.
It was, I don't know. It was something L State. That was like it is, college.
I guess there is that sort of awkward, and I wrote about this where I think it's so dangerous to have strong feelings about amateur talent as when you're not, you know, a professional evaluator of amateur talent, or at least reading someone who's has a career of synthesizing amateur talent assessments and things like that. You know, the people who do this for a living, because if it were that obvious or that easy, you know, I would be working for a team already. But I'm torn between the general principle of, hey, you know, a lot of teams have had success drafting polished college bats. They can be a pretty safe profile. And, you know, Theo Epstein's done very well doing that for a long time. The Cardinals did that for a long time to good results. But there is also that weird tension between did the White Sox do this just because they thought, oh, well, this sort of type of player is missing from our system and we'll just fill it out, because you don't want to be drafting for, like, quote, need necessarily. You know, certainly if they didn't think, I don't know, Berger was the best player available at 11 or so on. But I think that there is a fair argument that that was about where you should go anyway, like league wide.
And the White Sox win White Sox this game up.
Holy
real good.
Shit.
I turned the game off so I could free up some bandwidth. Ryan Goins in play runs. That seems.
So I made a little point about Swarzak not being like nails the last couple of months, but
how oddly prescient of you.
I would think with Berger and Sheets, they kind of are somewhat out on a limb with not like crazy, but like they're definitely on the high end of like viewing those guys. Berger is probably seen as a reach at 11. To some degree. I mean, obviously, if he actually really is a third baseman and actually is a average hit plus power guy, then, yeah, he's number 11 worthy. But most people think he's a first baseman and have some doubts about whether or not his kind of like Todd Frazier-style armbar or Gary Gaetti as Hostetler compared him to is actually going to hit for good average in major leagues. Sheets is a guy that they talked about being as high as thinking like maybe he's in the first round type of value, but you know, BA and MLB both had him in the 60s and they took him like 49th overall, and they obviously think his power is like going to be well above average. For more people think of him as a average hit, slightly above average power at first base, so they're on the high end of both those guys. If they're right, obviously they had him at the right value. If they're wrong, well, we'll probably revisit this. Skoug, you know, as much as we went through Skoug, whatever, as much as we went through this with Zach Collins last year about, like, the White Sox thinking you can catch and no one else can, I would say things are even more skewed to that end where you know, no one thinks you can catch. Skoug. No one thinks you can catch, and the White Sox, Hostetler was way more like, yeah, I don't know, we'll see, than he ever was with Collins. And Collins was seen as way more risky on that end. So I would hold out more optimism for him sticking. And, you know, if we look at him just as like a first base bat, he has a lot of power, but had nearly like a 30% K rate in college this year, which is eye-opening. I mean, he's made some progress on that front the last 6 weeks, 2 months, but that's a lot of whiffs in college ball.
I do wonder how much of a gap there really is, you know, to say guy got taken at 49 versus BA having him at 60 something. I feel like once you get the further out way you get from the top, like the more these tiers sort of blur together. And in my mind, I think there's less of a gap between some of these picks.
I was, right, it's not crazy at all. It's just like a little bit higher than the rest of the league.
Yeah. I was,
and, I mean, to that end, I mean, Jaron Kendall was a guy that they were linked with by, you know, every outlet repeatedly. And, you know, you had people like Jim Callis who were saying, yeah, I would take him like top five in the draft. And he slid to wherever the Dodgers were picking, 20 something. So,
yeah, he fell a lot the last couple of weeks from what I heard.
I think that the late round thing is obviously a total crapshoot. But like, I just remember on day three, out of curiosity, clicking on in the draft tracker, clicking on the best available players. And there were guys still available who were ranked in MLB.com's like top 200, and we were in like the 18th round. And, you know, Skoug is an example of that too, because I think MLB.com had him ranked like 48th overall. And, you know, so that would be a second round pick who the White Sox drafted in the 8th, 7th round, whatever. So I think that the outside of probably the top, I don't know, 30 to 40, I think that how the outlets view it and how the teams view it is like drastically, drastically different.
Yeah, and I guess this draft.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it depends so wildly, because you get to these players where it's like, you know, do you think he can stick at, you know, a valuable position, or is he going to have to slide down to like the corners somewhere? And if you if you're on the like upper end, if you're optimistic on one of those guys, maybe that's the difference between seeing them as a 60th overall guy versus the 150th, you know, like, because you get to those little like sort of binary decisions that change the whole profile in a way. So yeah, I think that's fair, James. Though they weren't like crazy overdrafts, but Berger was definitely like some more in the 15 to 20 range from what I was seeing. And they grabbed him at 11, and Sheets, as we discussed, was a little up as well.
I mean, it's definitely a draft where you have room to kind of like lean towards people you like and fit the profile you're looking for, and I think that's what happened.
And also, yeah, and like, you can't pass up the opportunity to draft Larry King's son also.
Yeah. And also, you know, like,
Murphy got Larry King on the phone.
If it isn't clear that there are talents that are really jumping out at you, if you do have a, maybe that is where organizational needs start breaking ties for you. Because there isn't like a clear, you know, third baseman of the future in the organization necessarily. And there isn't like a ton of. What?
I said Yon Moncada.
Yeah, well, it's going to be hard for him to play third and second at the same time. I know he's athletic, but.
He's a top prospect, Nick. He can do both.
It's true.
I can't believe you're insulting Nicky Delmonico to Colin's face like this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Also, have you seen Cody Ashe's AAA numbers? They're insane.
How about we just totally, like, destroyed Nick making a long and serious point, and now he's gone.
Oh, no, I
keep getting distracted by the ads for this Bud Light Radler because, holy cow, that sounds terrible.
The current MLB TV ad situation on a laptop is miserable.
Crossing off another Xbox BP Southside Catbird Speaks sponsor off the list.
Do you, James, I mean, is there any sense, I know that coming into the season it was like, we're going to be extra conservative, we're not going to call anyone up until they're super duper ready. I think we're far enough into the season now that the service time concerns are pretty minimized. It's been a few months in. I'm starting to get to that phase of the season where before the year we might have thought, hey, maybe Carson Fulmer will be up or Ronaldo Lopez or so on. Is there any sense that some of these guys are actually close to arriving in the majors?
Have you noticed how none of them are actually doing very well?
Yeah.
Carson Fulmer's been pretty flat out bad last six starts. Ronaldo Lopez has been fine, but is certainly not dominating AAA. Not racking up a ton of strikeouts, not keeping the ball in the air. I think he's already been homered on today. And Zach Birdie's been getting dinged up recently, and Lucas Giolito, he kind of actually had, you know, a bit of a turn of the tide the last four starts, but didn't get out of the fifth inning Saturday night or Friday night, whenever his last start was. So there's no one really in the starting rotation who's like, I mean, this, for the standard they set of, like, we won't have, like, no more questions for them in AAA before they get promoted. I don't think anyone's really reached that. Yamankata was flat-out awful for a couple weeks after he returned from his thumb injury. Only started having a couple good games this weekend. And who would you promote? Tyler Danish has been terrible since he got sent back down after looking like a competent major league starter who could miss bats in his debut. I don't know who in AAA I would really call up. Well, Michael Kopech, you might promote directly from AA since he has so much stuff, but he's been like running out of gas the last five starts. He hasn't pitched six innings since May.
Yeah, fair enough. No, I mean that basically answers my question, because there was a while where, you know, Fulmer got off to a really good start. Lopez had some really good starts early in the season, and Danish was obviously trending well, and then he got called up and he pitched well and he got sent back down. But that sort of broadly answers the question, like, you're hitting that time of year where you'd call these guys up, and none of them is really forcing the issue at all. Other than this kid Cody Ashe, like you said.
Yeah, that guy we should look into, because the numbers there are undeniable.
He's got more walks than strikeouts, OPS of 1,143.
Yeah, I don't even need to look at that guy play. You see those numbers, you know that's a stud.
Nicky Delmonico is still OPSing 800, for the record.
800 with kind of shaky defense at third base.
You know what? I don't want to talk about that.
What does an 800 OPS in AAA translate to in the majors?
I think like 950.
It's going to go up.
Yeah. No, he's the future.
The majors are easier than AAA.
It's true.
I don't, there's no reason for concern. There's no rush. But my guys are really having good minor league seasons of this top 10. Like, birdie strikeout numbers are still ridiculous, so I'm not worried that his stuff backed up or anything, but it's kind of a weird year. I'm probably pretty worried about Carson Palmer at this point.
Yeah.
He was always kind of high risk, I feel like, and his success became less integral when they traded for 800 other pitching prospects, but I guess it's not, I mean, are you worried to the point where you're worried he's going to be a starter, or are you worried to the point where you're worried he's going to be a major leaguer?
I wouldn't worry about that until, like, you actually see him as a reliever, and that doesn't work either. I mean, his stuff still looked fine in late April. He still threw low 90s, a lot of movement, a lot of sink. But no one's seen him recently, so I can't really comment on what's going wrong. But it's weird. It's definitely weird to not miss bats in AAA like this. I guess I'm worried. None of these guys have been relievers for a long period of time, so I don't know why. I wouldn't jump to the conclusion that they can't be relievers and really effective ones, such as everyone says they can be. But it's been kind of an iffy 2017 for a lot of their top 10. Other than Kopech, because Kopech is kind of at a high level, given how young he is anyway, and it's clear that he can still miss bats. I mean, the control is still crazy, but
and Kopech's
we
age,
knew that's going to be that way.
Kopech's even, younger experience-wise than his age. I mean, not for great reasons. I mean, obviously you don't want, like, a suspension and then injuring yourself in a fight to be the reasons why you haven't pitched all that much. But he's got even less experience than a normal 20-year-old would.
Yeah, Kopech is at 66 innings, and that is his career high in a season as a professional right now.
By one inning. Nice. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, it kind of makes sense that he might be fatigued. I mean, this is the hardest opposition he's ever faced. This is the most he's ever pitched. So, I'm not really concerned about that. And I do, James, you and I talked a little bit about this on Twitter like a while back. Do you think there's anything to, similar, in a similar type of issue as maybe Rodon had, where his stuff's just going to be, at a certain point, going to be so good that he's going to have a lot of learning that he has to do just in the majors, because it's going to be really hard to take that arsenal and put it in front of minor league hitters. He's not really going to be forced to be that fine. I mean, he can try to paint the corners anyway, but he's a competitor. He's still going to be trying to win these games and get these hitters out. And if I were him and I'm, behind a hitter, I'm just going to throw 102 right at him and probably get away with it.
He said something specifically that addressed this about developing his third pitch. Said, "I hate to sound like I'm patting myself on the back, but it's almost unnecessary to throw it at some point," referring to his changeup. "I have to remind myself to use it. I've given up a couple home runs on changeup this year because I'm speeding guys' bats up. It has become a better pitch, but I have to be smart about when I'm using it and to whom I'm using it. It's something that experience is going to kind of take over, and I'll get it down even more. But I'm comfortable throwing it now. I'm added a sinker to my repertoire as well. It's not necessarily a fourth pitch, pretty much another fastball, but at the same time, it's a disruption of timing too."
So Kopech agrees.
He's saying basically it's hard to throw a changeup when you can overwhelm every out of fastball slider, and no one in AA can catch up to 98. So why are you going to throw them 91?
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, he agrees with you.
Nice.
He simply name dropped you.
What a sweetie. Good looking out, Mikey. Thanks.
Yeah. Good guy. Yeah, but I also wouldn't. I think if he was walking the park in AAA, that might be its own level disaster.
Is Luis Robert going to stay, come stateside at all this year, or is the sense that he's going to be gone?
Han hinted that that was a possibility. I wouldn't be surprised by it at all. Maybe when short season ball starts, you break him in there, and that's what they do. Scouts have generally thought that the idea of having him play against 16 and 17-year-olds who are not uber 1-1 draft level prospects would probably get pretty silly pretty quickly.
Well, in five games so far in what league is this? This is the
DSL.
Yeah, he's got seven walks against two strikeouts and an OPS over 1,000.
Does he have a second hit yet? Because I thought he only had the one home run for a while.
He's got three.
He's got three hits?
Yeah, he's got a double.
He's got a single.
He's 3 for 4 on steals already. Because I think you were mentioning that he's above the scouting chart on speed now all of a sudden.
Yeah. I got word of a 6.260, which is above the speed scale. Now, whether that's what he looks like every single time, I don't know.
And like usage in game, I mean, it's different coming out of the box and coming out of sprinters blocks or whatever it is. But
I think the only responsible thing to tell listeners is that he's actually Billy Hamilton with plus hit and plus power.
Oh, yeah.
They'll proper responsible reactions and assessments of his value.
Billy Hamilton's an interesting tension between being such a unique and eye-catching player, but then he also plays for the Reds, so it's like, will people know who he is or not?
I think that's he can probably walk down the street without being bothered.
Could Luis Robert beat the Freeze? I think is a legit question. Yeah. I don't know. He was muscular enough. He was a national champion sprinter in college or something, I read.
The Freeze?
Yeah, that's where he came from.
Why is he called the Freeze? Because I feel like cold things aren't associated with speed.
I think it's something sponsorship related.
Like an AC sponsor.
Yeah.
Like, well, that weatherproofing like service that he's sponsoring.
He lost, though. Didn't he lose the other day? Didn't I read that?
Yeah.
So, the Freeze sucks.
He gave the guy like a 10-second head start.
He sucks. I could beat him.
It's a 200-foot head start, James.
He broke Collins' heart.
I bet Nicky Delmonico could beat the Freeze.
Colin yells. Face red hot with anger, tears streaming down his cheeks, slamming his bedroom door shut.
Who is the grittiest world-class sprinter?
Wait, what?
Who is the grittiest world-class sprinter? Is there anyone who just doesn't have top-end speed but wins sprinting races just grinding and grit?
Darren Erstad.
I don't know if I could name more than two or three world-class sprinters, so I don't think I can answer that question.
Who James, were you asking that question because you knew the answer and you wanted to bring it up?
No. The answer is Herb Washington. That's the guy's name, right? Who was signed just to be a pinch runner way back in the day, famously never got an at-bat, and wasn't actually very good at stolen bases.
I know Terrence Gore is still kicking around in the minors.
He hit his first career home run at any level.
I didn't notice that his career he's hitless in the majors.
In his career?
Yeah.
How many PAs? I mean, he's
9, but he's played in 38 games.
So he is basically Herb Washington. I got that name right. Oakland in 74 and 75.
I wasn't alive yet.
Terrence Gore is 19 for 21 on stolen bases in his career. He has more than twice as many steals as he has plate appearances.
Herb Washington appeared in 105 games for Oakland in 74 and 75, had 0 plate appearances. And he was 31 for 48 in stolen bases, so he wasn't even really good at what they signed him to do.
No, and you could, man, I feel like you could do some really cool stuff in with like modern athletes if you weren't doing these like 14-man bullpen nonsense.
You could easily have a guy like that whose entire job is just late game pinch runner.
Kendry Morales just hit a baseball to the moon.
Yeah, off Dan Jennings. FIP is not going to normalize today.
Just so you guys know, we said these things before the home runs happened about Swarzak and Jennings. That's where you get this great analysis.
Yeah,
from.
Yeah. We
recorded this podcast 11 p.m. on Sunday night. Don't believe these liars.
Herb Washington.
You are really hung up on Herb Washington.
It's fascinating. And the fact that he sucked at stealing bases.
Speaking of trade candidates, it's not performing up to expectations. Avisail Garcia is 0-for-3 with 3 Ks today.
Against a lefty.
Against a bad velocity lefty, and albeit a lefty who's had some success. Apparently he's being traded to the Cardinals or something.
That was a really iffy report, like Cafardo linked to him to the Cardinals.
Along with J.D. Martinez.
Yeah, that seems really vague.
And he acted like it was something like, as we all... Am I remembering correctly? It was like, as we all know, this is the ongoing saga of the Cardinals' courtship for episode.
Yeah, he did mention it like, kind of very nonchalantly.
It's like, dude, this is the first I've heard of it. And, like, the Cardinals are 31-36. They DFA'd their third baseman. They, like... They fired their hitting coach.
They're not doing that.
No, they're behind. Colin and I were talking about this yesterday. Is there any team other than, like, so there's the Brewers and Cubs competing for the NL Central, but, like, barring something really weird happening, like, the wild card spots in the NL are spoken for, correct?
Yeah.
Like, the White Sox would totally hold them over a barrel for Avisail Garcia, and that's not what they want to do right now.
It's just like the wild card spots in both leagues pretty much feel.
I don't know if
America. But the Cardinals are fully aware of like the weakness of their major league roster this year. They're not going to like piss away major resources to get a corner outfielder who might be pretty good
for 2 years.
Who is very good. How dare you?
He's only under contract for 2 more years, right?
I think so.
18 and 19. So, I mean, yeah, he's not a rental, but, you know, it's not. And he's so weird, too, because he was so freaking bad for so long. Like, I mean, he's still young, but this is still a very Babbitt-y performance to date. And, you know, if he winds up with a 280 batting average with like 20 some home runs at the end of the year, like I'll still consider that a success beyond what I was anticipating coming into this year. But
I mean, it's weird as hell. Cause like if you took Avisail Garcia before the season, if I told you like he's going to make one key adjustment,
one weird
be
trick
better, what would you guess that it would be?
One weird trick. White Sox fans hate it.
Yeah.
Right, it wouldn't be hit it more to opposite field, right?
Yeah, he's hitting it more opposite. He's more aggressive. Like, one of the least patient hitters in baseball is swinging more.
And yeah, he needs to lean in more to his, like, totally weird profile.
Yeah, which is kind of, like, a so-weird-it's-genius move. To, like, well, he's not going to get suddenly good at these things he's, like, not good at all at. Just emphasize, like, hell, hitting the opposite field and swinging. swinging crazy offense, but you know it's kind of like the ultimate. You know, I don't have anything to lose. We're already like losing confidence in your ability to be a major leaguer. Just do what you're good at more, type of thing that you really can't. It's not really like a logical thing to turn to until you've reached already like this point of desperation. But so it's kind of funny that it's working.
But unless you think he can hit 310 plus. Moving forward is like a true talent level. I mean, he settles in as what, like a 280, 320, and then whatever his slugging settles in at sort of hitter, which for a corner outfielder is, you know, fine. Like that's a fine corner outfielder, but that's not, you know, that's not like a cornerstone player by any means. It's not like a plus player. That's, you know, it's a decent corner outfielder.
Right. That would probably be more my optimistic look for him is that he just, plays good enough to be a regular.
Yeah, like a 110 to 115 OPS plus guy instead of 150 or wherever he is right now.
Which coming into the season we would take in a heartbeat for his career.
I was advocating they DFA him. Like,
yeah.
I didn't see the point. Once they clearly, you know, waved the white flag over the winter, it was like, all right, well, you know, that's what this season is for now, is chasing the They started the year with Jacob May in center, so it's not like he's taking playing time away from anybody. Fine. But, you know, most teams wouldn't have given him this many chances.
Yeah, but the fact that we can now see a trajectory for Avisail where he becomes at average big league regular as opposed to being going the road of Dion Viciato is pretty great. It's awesome. Mm-hmm.
The two things that are kind of hard to see lasting, like it's already kind of perplexing that we've gone this long without the league trying to bust him inside more. Getting him to chase low and away was just so effective for so many years. I guess that's understandable that's still a report on him. And he has been very good at punishing people when they miss more towards the middle when they're trying to get inside on them. So that kind of, takes away the incentive of it. But also the thing that Todd Stevenson said, what's going to happen when people bust him inside. He's like, well, he's just going to lay off balls. And, we'll concede when people nail him perfectly, in on the hands and hit that edge of the strike zone. So I think the unsustainable there is hoping that Avisail Garcia to date is disciplined enough to lay off balls. You'd think you'd probably get in the chase inside on things off the plate. So that would be where I would see things falling apart for him.
Go ahead. But I do think it is fair to say for most hitters, except for, the transcendent ones, even most good hitters, the sense that I get from limited conversations and what I've read is that, you can't guard against every perfectly executed pitch. You just have to you're looking for your pitch. You're trying to maybe defend against a couple of things, but you're looking for your pitch. And if they throw you if they execute a perfect pitch, that's kind of, unless you're Trout or, Prime Pools or something, then yeah, that beats you. And I feel like pitching perfectly inside isn't something a lot of pitchers can do on a regular basis. So it may not be this fatal flaw. And the question, then I guess you're right. It becomes can Avisail just not get himself out on the pitches that aren't perfect, but are inside?
Yeah, I definitely have come to have a lot of respect for the way Stevenson has kind of tilted the entire Avisail approach around just challenging pitchers to execute perfectly and hit his flawed spot. I just wonder if he has the type of precision to make the degree of difficulties that high for people to hit inside. Feel like it might eventually help people out on the inside pitches.
So Carson Kelly's definitely coming over within the week for Avisail.
He was on a flight to Chicago with me. We were talking. I gave him both of my, the little cinnamon biscuits they give you to dip in coffee. Because, I said he needs his strength for Chicago, and he thanked me.
It's that inside information we appreciate. James, I don't know if does anybody else have anything else for James or anything else, any observations or, deep abiding fears that they wanted to discuss on the air before we start wrapping up?
Wow, very strong.
James, is there? Oh, here, I want to go on a positive note. The sense that I get from your writing, and everybody should subscribe to The Athletic, if you're listening to this podcast, it'd be weird if you weren't, wouldn't get your money's worth from reading James's writing. And hey, if you happen to be a Bulls fan or something on top of it, so much the better. You get that content too. But from reading James' writing, I don't think I'm breaking the paywall here to say it seems you really like Rick Renteria, and the players really like Rick Renteria also. Would you like to, can I give you a talk about question? Say talk about Rick Renteria?
I don't respond to talk about questions. I'm sorry. This podcast is over.
Yeah, but do you ask talk about questions? Be honest.
I actually did. Technically, I said, can I ask you a talk about question? I didn't ask.
The answer is no.
All right. what are your impressions of Rick Renteria?
He's built for it. He's a highly engaged, energetic person. I've always thought that the having just a Spanish-speaking manager touting that has kind of been simplistic. And to some degree, I still think it is. I think it'd probably be better if you have a low-energy, not-engaged manager who can at least speak clearly to his players. But I think it plays up. It plays up with Renteria to be bilingual because he's already so engaged and so active and already very hands-on and talking to people in dugout and working them through scenarios, the fact that he can do so directly with his players, like Alan Hansen, like Larry Garcia, like Abisail Garcia, and like manage them and talk to them as they work through like at bat to at bat and situation to situation. It probably plays up a lot that they probably have never had a major league manager who has been so invested and so engaging with them at any point in their careers, whether that's entirely a point to their turnaround or the fact that Larry Garcia, you know, was making more contact last year in AAA and we should have, you know, just expected a different player, or whether the fact that Abisail Garcia, you know, was always going to figure it out. I don't know. And maybe Alan Hansen continues to be kind of a, you know, regular old forgettable utility guy no matter what. But I think it's interesting that the White Sox basically acquired Hansen, somebody who, you know, has talent, but really hasn't been an exceptional standout guy since, you know, high A. He had decent numbers in double A, if you account for the fact that he's young for the level, but other than that, you know, hasn't really been that exceptional since then. A guy who, you know, didn't develop the way teams, the Pirates wanted him to, wasn't as engaged and focused as maybe they wanted to. And basically, the White Sox took a chance on him as we have a manager who will get after this guy. I think the idea that they have something approaching maybe a market inefficiency in Renteria as someone who is going to be engaging, is going to try to coach up guys directly, is interesting. It's something you should be optimistic about. The fact that they sprayed beer and ketchup and Listerine on him after his 100th victory is more just a fun side story.
Yeah.
Did you say ketchup and Listerine? I mean,
what?
Did you say ketchup and Listerine?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh.
They didn't say that for your Sweet 16, Kyle?
Yes.
But yeah, I mean, you have the aforementioned Garcias. You also have Yolmer Sanchez and, yeah, I guess now over a tiny sample, Alan Hansen, having the best seasons of their careers and looking like they're taking meaningful steps forward in their mid-20s. And I'm sure there's more to it than just working with Rick Renteria, but it is interesting and something that we haven't seen for this organization in a long time. But I think...
I don't think the starters love as quick of the hook that he has, but I don't think it's going to be the major thing against him.
Well, it's not like Renteria is on an island with that. I mean, that's the way the league is going, and certainly with the personnel they've had in the rotation this year kind of also calls for it. I mean, the White Sox were late on that trend with times to the order penalty, and that was partially because, like, Chris Sale facing hitters a fourth time is still better than pretty much everybody else anyway. So it's not like Renteria is an outlier with that.
Yeah, it is funny how their stats just like trended down tremendously for pitches per start once they lost a future Hall of Fame level starter.
And Quintana stopped pitching like, you know, an all star, at least for now. Great. James, is there anything else you want to plug other than The Athletic? I know you were working on a science fiction themed cookbook as well.
It was a space opera starring Space King Rick Renteria. you were going to write the foreword for it, I believe.
I like Space King as a nickname a lot. Some of it feels a little bit cruel in its origin, especially now that Ventura has departed. But James, if you want to push Space King as a nickname for Renteria, I have your back 100%.
I'm coming up with something this week. The Athletic pushes us to do, ask every player on the team about something. They wanted me to do like, talk about their walk up song or their cheat day, meal. I decided to ask every pitcher about their first career strikeout, which I found was pretty fun. James Shields, just to give you an idea of his age, his first career strikeout, it was Javi Lopez.
Nice.
That is good.
Mike Pelfrey was Hanley Ramirez, and also gave up a home run that game to Hanley Ramirez. And Zach Putnam, the first thing he ever did on the Major League mound was give up a home run to Adrian Beltre.
Well, that's pretty cool.
Cool.
I asked Josh Edgen about that after his debut, and he was like so stoked that he gave up a dinger to Chipper Jones. But great, so keep an eye out for that. That's what I had, Colin.
Now, if you've only started listening to this podcast and reading our website for the past 3 months, James is at J.R. Feagan, right? Not J.R. Feagan 1.
No, not like my Skype name.
and Beeps, next time we talk on a podcast, you'll probably be a married man. So good luck with that, and congrats.
Oh, thank you. Thank
congrats,
you.
Congrats, man.
Yeah, thank you. Next Saturday.
All right. Well, see everyone later.